This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now here's a look at what's coming up on the John Oakley Show podcast.
Now there's some great kids out there, but it doesn't seem like they're one of them.
The University of Toronto has divested before, and they have an ethical investment policy, right? And so really all we're asking is for them to adhere to that.
BC never had those mechanisms in place. So there's nothing really pushing people into getting better. We're just enabling them.
It's a great day for a podcast. Once again, here he is, John Oakley.
Here I be, just what the doctor ordered. Great afternoon for Talk Radio. Not so much in Leafland. I guess they're cleaning out their lockers. Still very curious as to what it was that was ailing Austin Matthews. That's a real conundrum. Anyway, be that as it may, it's all in the rearview mirror now. I remember running into Brian Burke. He used to be the head of the operation there. With the Maple Leafs. Anyway, the manager. And this is where it was interesting because I remember him saying one time he wouldn't hire anybody who was a Gen Z or a millennial. And I didn't know why he had said that. So when I ran into him at the bank on Bayview Avenue, I said, "Can I ask you a question?" He said, "Yeah, go ahead." So I asked him, "Why is that?" And he said, "Well, because you always got to explain stuff to them." I said, "Oh." And then I didn't want him to explain it any further lest he actually would see the irony in that. But, you know, it was funny because I was reading on Reddit. There was a manager on the manager's forum complaining about essentially the same thing with Gen Z and young millennial workers. They struggle with basic tasks, often asking a million questions after being told to figure it out or even giving up completely. It wasn't like this 5 to 10 years ago. Something, is there something cultural? What's happened during the pandemic? Well, let's find out from somebody who's right there and knows about things firsthand. Professor Steve Jordans is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto's Scarborough campus, and he's joined us here on The Oakley Show to explain. Professor, good to have you with us. Good afternoon.
Hey, really great to be here, John.
So, have you encountered this phenomenon that perhaps the young folks, the Gen Zs and the millennials, maybe lacking critical thinking skills or need some help? How do you assess this phenomenon?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely something that's real and sort of part and parcel of a whole general trend we're seeing of sort of a more shallow interaction with the world. And, you know, we can trace some of this to things like text messages where you can think, you know, for 10 minutes before responding to that message. And so you have all the safety of working at your own time and your own speed. And you also are free of all the nonverbal stuff. And so a lot of the people that grew up with this seem to like these safe, shallow contexts where they don't go deep. They hang out with people they agree with. They talk to people they agree with, you know. And so that's really, critical thinking is a skill and you need to practice it. And I think the world they live in just doesn't give them the opportunities for practice that our world did.
So they're losing the chops for it. And that's a dangerous development, is it not?
Yeah, and more that they're never gaining the chops in the first place is kind of, you know, how you think of it. If we just imagine, you know, when we grew up, there was sort of two contexts where we would be engaged in critical thought. And one of them was indeed at school. But again, even schools have never been really good at teaching critical thought. They're really good at teaching information and knowledge. But I sometimes say, you know, if someone came to me and said, "I'd like to learn guitar," I want to say, "Do you want to learn to play guitar? Or do you want information about guitar?" Because information we can do easy. We can sit you down in a lecture hall with an expert and you can learn a lot in an hour easily. If you want to play, now you really need to stick with it, practice regularly in a structured environment with lots of support. And so that's what schools and universities would have to do to really develop these skills well. And that's something I'm very passionate about and trying to bring about. But at the same time, the world outside the school is not giving the same opportunities for critical thought that it used to. We really live in this polarized world where people don't hang out with people with different opinions and don't have deep conversations with them like we used to. And that's a huge practice gone.
Again, with Steve Jordans, professor of psychology at the U of T Scarborough campus, we're talking about Gen Z and millennials to a certain extent lacking critical thinking. And he's confirmed what some managers have also posted on Reddit. Let me just back up. How would we define critical thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's largely the ability to really analyze and take apart something and to see if there's any suboptimalities in it. Like, you know, it could be an argument where someone presents you with an argument and you're like, okay, let me think deeply about that argument. Not necessarily to be contrary, but just to kind of take the pieces apart, see if they all fit together, see if there's any flaws in it. And so it really requires a sort of focused mindset. And it requires one to go deeper to think, you know, how these things fit and whether they support some sort of assumption or conclusion. And so that sort of focused thought is hard for Gen Zs and millennials because they're continually being distracted by their phone. They live in a world where they're just continually pulled away. And it's almost like they've gotten into a habit of never really doing that deep thinking. That I shouldn't say never, that's too extreme, but not doing it to the same extent that we did. And therefore, they are like a hockey, if we want to stick with your hockey analogy, you know, they are like a hockey player that's gotten maybe a third or less of the practice. And so, yeah, you throw them on the ice, they're not going to seem confident and they're not going to seem very good relative to the other players simply because they haven't had as much practice.
So you allude to social media then and their phones. Do you think that this is compounded or it's part and parcel of the same thing, anxiety, identity issues, depression, maybe fear of failure, all of these things that are preying on their young minds?
Yeah, and a lot of them actually link to something called social connection. And this is, I think, where a lot of these devices have really made their world impoverished. So your ability to, I always tell this joke, you know, we have friends and then we have good friends, they help us move. And then we have really good friends, they help us move bodies. That third one's a little extreme, but that notion of, you know, having friends in your life that will really be there and you know, be there when you need them. And they help us to deal with anxiety and all of these things. And kids today just don't have as many friends like that. And that's largely because you get that by being with somebody and going through emotional experiences together. That's what forms those trust relationships that allow you to reveal things and go deeper. And again, so often the relationships they're having is one person's in the bedroom, one place, someone else's bedroom, some other place and saying, you know, what do you think of that TV show or whatever? They're just not having these deep face-to-face, real-time sort of interactions. And therefore, they're lacking competency. They're becoming very socially anxious. They can't deal with chronic stresses as well. Social connection is the number one predictor of health, happiness, and that's both physical and mental health. And that's where they're really kind of losing a lot of that practice, a lot of that skill, and so much goes with that when you lose that.
Was this exacerbated by the pandemic?
Yeah, it absolutely was. I work a little bit with something called the GenWell Initiative, who's been worried about this increasing trend towards isolation and loneliness and lack of social connection. And they've been tracking this since before the pandemic. So it was certainly happening already. But the pandemic seems to have, sort of hit the gas pedal a little bit where people really develop some really bad habits. Plus, a lot of these young people could not get social connection at a time they need it so badly. You know, when we're 13, 14, 15, 16, that's when we start thinking about leaving our home and we start forming those social networks that we're going to rely on. And for a lot of these students, that process was just rudely interrupted. And now they're older, but they haven't got the experience that they would have had during those years. And so they feel behind. They are behind.
What would the optimum parental role or responsibility then be?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're trying really hard to give a good answer to that question. And it'll be a funny kind of interesting answer because we know tech is part of the problem here or a large part of the problem, but we're trying to use tech to help students get back these communication skills. Specifically, we're building a platform called Talk Lab where students can learn about effective techniques like active listening and how to start a conversation, how to close it, all these things. But then they can practice it with bots. So we've created bots that you can have full out discussions with. And that's a safer place for them to practice. They're scared. There's something called the fear of negative evaluation. They worry about talking to other human beings. They think it won't go well. They're usually wrong, by the way. It almost always does go well. But if we can get them to practice the skills talking with bots that don't scare them and then get them to import those skills into their life, that's an approach we're trying to take now. So using AI to solve a problem caused by technology.
Wow, interesting and ironic, but very informative. Professor Steve Jordans, professor of psychology at the U of T Scarborough campus. Really, really appreciate it. Great conversation. Thank you for sharing.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, John.
decriminalization. How well has it worked in BC, and should we follow suit? We'll get to that more in moments on The Oakley Show, 640 Toronto.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
BC never had those mechanisms in place. So there's nothing really pushing people into getting better. We're just enabling them.
Here he is, John Oakley.
Great afternoon for Talk Radio. Now, BC, as is well documented, have gone down the road of decriminalization. As a matter of fact, they got special dispensation from the feds to allow for small amounts of hard drugs to be consumed. Problem was, the consumption happened in public spaces. And so now the Premier, Eby, has gone back and said, listen, Ottawa, maybe you can put the imposition back on some of these drugs because things are out of control here in a lot of cases. But I see where the Toronto Star's lead editorial today had to do with let's not rush to judgment, Ontario or Toronto specifically asking for the same kind of dispensation as they got out in BC is something that would be necessary to do. Otherwise, the consequences of the opioid crisis and just hard drugs in general are so monumental. The least we can do is allow for decriminalization and so on and so forth. Well, Adam Szivo has covered this project. He's a columnist with the National Post, and he's also, as I said, been very, very involved in drug policy. And he joins us this afternoon from Israel, as a matter of course. Adam, always a pleasure. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, Adam, I'm anxious to have you back because I was reading this lead editorial in today's Toronto Star, and they're making it sound like, you know, there's a rush to judgment here where we're naysaying decriminalization and maybe picking up on what Eby has now had to go back and ask the feds to rescind or retract on. They say, you know, this is something that requires more than the time that's been allowed in BC. The project started, a pilot project, January 31st of last year. Or are there conclusive signs that decriminalization has not worked? What's your take?
I think so. We just need to look at the incredible public disorder that we see in BC, which is unacceptable. I mean, the key example here is the fact that right now in most hospitals in BC, it is possible for drug addicts to smoke meth and fentanyl in their rooms, even if that endangers surrounding patients and nurses. Parents across the province feel deeply frustrated by the fact that syringes are showing up everywhere on playgrounds and places where kids play. People don't feel safe. I was just in Vancouver a few weeks ago. I felt unsafe walking in many neighborhoods. It was just ubiquitous. It was not something that people want to see. And I read through the Toronto Star's editorial, and the way that they downplayed these harms was, I thought, really atrocious. And the way that they framed the issue, I thought, was misleading and, in a sense, deeply ignorant of what's actually going on with decrim.
Well, for example, they say BC's problems have virtually nothing to do with decriminalization and virtually everything to do with its difficulties in regulating public spaces. So that's what it's all about, regulating public spaces. I don't know how you can keep a handle on every public space. I mean, when we've got people clamoring to defund the police or freeze their budgets, but square that circle for me. What do you say in response? Public spaces, that's just the thing that needs to be regulated and we'll be all good and good to go.
Well, I'm going to make two points here. The first point here is that Toronto Star's article, their argument doesn't make any sense at all. Because the primary argument made in defense of decriminalization is that it allows people to use in public around other drug users and other members of society, so that if you overdose because you got the wrong dose, your drug's contaminated, that someone can come to you and reverse that overdose and save your life. So if they're arguing that decriminalization should be maintained, but that public use should be banned, then they need to make a different case for why decriminalization should be protected. But they haven't really done that here. They've kind of hollowed out the main reason why we are experimenting with decrim, and they haven't provided a strong alternative justification. Now, the second thing is that they completely misunderstand why decriminalization failed. And I've written about this quite extensively. In Portugal, which decriminalized drugs 20 years ago, what they did is that they invested heavily into treatment so that if you wanted to get better, you could get into rehab or detox right away. And what they didn't do is let people do drugs wherever they want with no consequence. Decriminalization in Portugal, which was successful, essentially created an alternative model of justice where if you were caught using in public or possessing a small amount of drugs, you were sent to a dissuasion committee, which was composed of a psychologist, a social worker, and a lawyer, and they could use coercive methods such as fines to pressure you into treatment. So there was a mechanism to actually push people into healthcare. DC never had those mechanisms in place. So there's nothing really pushing people into getting better. We're just enabling them. And that's the main difference between Portuguese decriminalization, which worked really well, and BC's decriminalization, which failed. But all of this is omitted by the Toronto Star because it seems as if their editorial board doesn't understand basic facts about drug policy.
Again, with Adam Szivo, columnist with the National Post, on this matter of decriminalization, because Toronto is looking to follow suit or replicate the experiment, the pilot project out there in BC, which seems like it's somehow unraveling. And further to the piece in the Star, it says, it would, of course, have been wise had BC excluded public spaces from its original exemption request. But hindsight's 20/20. Why they didn't foresee that this could be problematic is kind of interesting. But again, it gets back to, you know, public spaces. If we could just regulate those and make sure, you know, no needles in the park or playgrounds and no drug dealers coming into hospital room, we'd be good to go. It would have the desired impact and effect, and it would be the better way forward, best practices. But you've denied that, or you say that that's maybe adult thinking. Again, excluding public space. So if Toronto were to do this, I mean, you're saying just don't even go down this road to begin with, if I'm reading you right.
No. I mean, like, if you want to do decriminalization, there's a way to do it responsibly. And essentially, the Portuguese model, as I described before, is a model where you have a system of justice in place that enables, like, sorry, that ensures that there's some level of accountability, that people aren't just allowed to do whatever they want. It's just that the system of accountability, which is put into place, is a non-criminal one, which focuses on sending people into healthcare rather than jail, and doesn't saddle them with a criminal record that destroys their lives. What the Toronto Star seems to be advocating for is a kind of free-for-all, exclude that you have, you know, public spaces are excluded from decrim, but everything else is allowed. And that just doesn't work. That didn't work in BC. That didn't work in Oregon. So I don't know what I don't know why they think that their model would potentially work.
Well, you know, this is the thing you're hearing from certain quarters, and I'm sure they would agree. This is framed exclusively as a health issue, but you're saying there's got to be a criminal component to it.
Not a criminal component per se.
A justice component, let's say.
There needs to be an accountability component, right? So these drug courts, they ensure that there's accountability, but the accountability is done outside of the criminal justice system, right? So there are coercive mechanisms in play, like fines, and they're meant to push you into healthcare, but not into jail, right? So we're treating addiction in this case as not as a criminal issue, but there's still accountability. And I think that's something that people often fail to understand, is that you can have accountability without involving the criminal justice system.
Well, we're already seeing with the safe injection sites and harm reduction sites that there are social consequences or collateral damage to all of this in neighborhoods, in these public spaces. It actually lends itself to a greater licentiousness, doesn't it?
It does. And here's the thing, is that it's also deeply unfair to drug users themselves, because when someone is trying to get clean, when they're in early rehab, it's very difficult to maintain your sobriety if you are constantly surrounded by reminders of substance use. I feel bad for people who are trying to get off drugs in downtown Vancouver and have to constantly be triggered by open scenes of people smoking crack, meth, and fentanyl everywhere downtown. And we fail to think about that. And we fail to think about how destigmatizing drugs often encourages people to use drugs. Stigma works. You know, we shouldn't stigmatize people. We should stigmatize drug use, though. And the best example of this is smoking, right? So we stigmatize the action of smoking without stigmatizing smokers themselves. And through that, through creating a taboo, we were able to significantly reduce smoking rates over the course of a generation or two and save countless lives. That was one of the most profound public health victories we've had over the past few decades. Yet for some reason, when it comes to harder drugs, which are more dangerous and more lethal, we think that destigmatizing drugs is somehow, that it somehow makes sense.
Adam, before I let you go, you're in Israel as we speak, this on National Holocaust Remembrance Day. Tell me what the mood is like in Israel right now, and what's the perspective for the most part, I guess, in sweeping general terms about these protests on college and university campuses?
Okay, three things. Tel Aviv is a bubble. Life here is fairly normal. People are enjoying the beach, restaurants, cafes. South of Israel is still very traumatized. When you go to the kibbutz, you know, it's half empty. Signs of October 7th are still everywhere. And every single person thinks that these pro-Hamas protests happening in Canada and the United States are absurd.
Okay, rather succinct. I appreciate it. Stay well and hope to talk down the road.
Thank you for having me back on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Likewise. Adam Szabo, columnist with the National Post. We're coming back in a moment. I did want to get Hank Kadzinga in here because there's a story, and I don't know if you followed it, but last fall, a Toronto police superintendent, Stacey Clark, who'd broken the glass barrier, first black woman to be elevated to that position within the ranks of the police, actually helped some, and this was by her own admission, it was a promotional cheating scandal, rocked the force back in 2022. And what she had done is given the answers to about a half a dozen officers during the promotional process where they had to be interviewed, and she gave them basically a heads up as to what the questions would be because she had sat on one of these panels herself. And so in so doing, it sort of prepared them in advance. Who were these candidates to be elevated or promoted to sergeant? Well, they mostly racialized people, you know, minority groups, black and brown candidates. And this is where she's being lauded in some circles as a pioneer and one who is trying to break through the systemic racism within the force. However, she's facing this disciplinary hearing, or at least it's sentencing, on seven counts of professional misconduct, which could even lead to demotion or dismissal. We'll see what Hank Kadzinga says when he weighs in next here on The Oakley Show, 640 Toronto.
Credibility as a police officer is everything. Anytime you're going to speak in public or testify in court, your credibility can be brought into question. It's a real problem.
Here he is, John Oakley.
Great afternoon, 4 Talk Radio. There's a situation I was alluding to just moments ago of a police superintendent here in the Toronto force, Stacey Clark, who's now facing the music for something that she did, by her own admission, pled guilty to, a promotional cheating scandal where she was mentoring, I guess, six applicants for sergeant and had given them answers in advance. That was admitted in court. Now she's facing the music. So let's find out what potentially could await and how this whole process works, because some are in her corner believing that she was just trying to advance racialized minorities to break through either the glass ceiling or get around or through systemic racism within the force. Hank Kadzinga is back with us, 640 Toronto police and crime expert. Hank, good to have you on board. Good afternoon.
John, always amazing to talk to you.
Thank you. It's a pretty serious transgression, isn't it?
It's a very serious transgression. I mean, we've seen it before in the promotional process of the Toronto Police Service. We've never seen it quite at this rank where somebody's gotten caught and, you know, pled guilty, owned up to her mistakes, and is now going through the sentencing phase at the tribunal and trying to explain why she did what she did.
How'd she get caught?
I'm not sure of the exact details. From what I understand, she was not properly mentoring about half a dozen officers, and one of those officers didn't feel right about it and turned around and reported it to professional standards. And a lot of the information was on cellular phones and text messages and whatnot. And so professional standards did their investigation and laid the charges pretty quickly when this happened.
Now, as Toronto's first Black female superintendent, she was a pioneer in a sense, broke through a certain ceiling or level, and so really had achieved a rather prestigious position, correct?
Superintendent is a very prestigious position. It's, you know, if you look at the ranks above superintendent, you've got a staff superintendent and then a deputy chief and then the chief. So it's a very high rank. It's your unit commander of a large division or a couple of smaller divisions at that point in time in your career.
So she pled guilty to, seven counts of professional misconduct. What potentially could await her here then?
Well, I'm just thinking back to, there's been a couple of scandals about cheating during the promotional process of the Toronto Police Service, and one case in particular where an officer was having the answers fed to him during one of the promotional exams through an earpiece from somebody else waiting out in the parking lot. And I believe he was demoted two ranks as a constable, so from first class back down to third class. And I believe that's what the prosecutor is asking for here, is a demotion of two ranks. So she'd be reduced from a superintendent back down to a staff sergeant. Defense, I don't know if they've put the position forward yet, but hypothetically, if they say, okay, we recommend a reduction of rank of one step, so down to inspector, then it's up to the tribunal hearings officer what the appropriate punishment was. But if they're going by case law, I think it's going to be two ranks.
Well, they're saying this disciplinary hearing is going to extend for about 5 days. Why so long?
I think she's going to call a lot of witnesses. I think we heard today that the former chief, Mark Saunders, is going to be a witness. It'll be interesting to see what he has to say about the whole situation. I believe this broke either right at the tail end of his time as chief or just after he had left in 2020. And there'll be other character witnesses testifying on behalf of Stacey. And, 5 days is a long time to hear from character witnesses and have submissions and whatnot. And we'll see how long it takes for the hearings officer to come up with a decision after that.
Again, with Hank Itzing, a 640 Toronto police and crime expert. So Hank, there are some who are obviously in her corner and defending her, believing that she was trying to address equity problems within the force. Does that merit any consideration?
I think it does. When this happened, it was shortly after George Floyd was murdered down in the United States, and City Council actually came up with recommendations for the Toronto Police Service to help to improve the situation with any Black racism within the police service. And that's right around the same time that this broke. So I think her intentions were noble, but I don't think she went about it the right way. Cheating is never acceptable. And it certainly tarnishes her reputation, the reputation of the police service, and her credibility. And that's one thing that personally I've said time and time again, is credibility as a police officer is everything. Anytime you're going to speak in public or testify in court, your credibility can be brought into question. It's a real problem.
Yeah, well, it's like trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, Seriously, I mean, once you've fallen, there's no return. But again, with Hank Itzinga, so you've spent 34 years on the force, and you know the ins and outs. One of the arguments, as well as, her trying to put her finger on the scales, even conducting mock interviews and giving actual questions from other sergeant interviews, is that she wanted to not only achieve certain equity there or break through the racial barrier. She said, this is something, or it's been suggested that the TPS is still a male-dominated old boys club, is it?
I think that still exists. I think racism is a problem within the service. I think, the old boys club is still in existence. It's not in complete control the way it used to be, but I think it is still there. And she's come into a lot of hurdles in her career, but still gotten promoted relatively quickly and at a young age to a very high rank. So it's tough to make the argument then that the system is working against her. And,
you know, she's done very well in a short amount of time, and she's trying to pull some other individuals up with her to try and bolster those numbers, right? We've seen it, you know, trying to achieve equal numbers with males and females on the police service and visible minorities as well. It's been a problem for a long time, and her trying to help the situation, like I said, it's noble. It's just not the right way to do it, by cheating.
How old is she? Do you know?
She's younger than me. I remember when I was a sergeant at 51 Division, and she was a police constable at the time. So I'm going to guess maybe in her mid-40s now.
Okay, well, okay, all right. Just wanted to contextualize to see, you know, making her way up the food chain, as you say, relatively young. But you intrigued me with something you said, that racism's still a problem on the force. In what way is it a problem?
Oh, we could probably dedicate an hour or two to that discussion, John. You know, I think the statement that Interim Chief Jim Raymer made a couple of years ago with his apology for systemic racism within the police service certainly touched a lot of nerves. And a lot of studies were conducted to get it to that point. And like I said, shortly after the George Floyd murder, there were a lot of recommendations from the city towards the police service. And I personally, I've seen it in the police service. I've seen it at all levels in the police service. And it's something that shouldn't be tolerated, much like cheating shouldn't be tolerated. The behavior of the police officers have to be held to a higher standard, and anything like that should be addressed immediately and harshly as well.
So you're saying it lives within the force, or does it manifest itself in the way that law enforcement is conducted by the police service?
Well, it lives in the force, and the force is a reflection of society. And, you know, we draw our people from society into the police service. And so as much as racism exists in society, we're certainly seeing it in these recent months and days, it exists as well in the police service and manifests itself in different ways within the police service as well.
That's just very interesting and very candid. I really appreciate your time as always, and for the candor especially, Hank Gudzinga, 640 Toronto Police and Crime Expert. Appreciate it. Look forward to talking again real soon.
Thanks, John. Anytime.
You got it. We'll leave on that note. Otherwise, a great day for talk radio in the books. Many, many thanks, David J. Hunter, technical operator, Michael J. Downey, producer, and to you.
Listen to the John Oakley Show live each weekday afternoon from 3 until 6. If you live in the Toronto area, just turn that AM dial to 640 and listen anywhere on earth 24 hours a day by going to 640toronto.com. Follow on Twitter at @AM640Oakley. You've been listening to A Curious Cast. New podcasts and shows are debuting all the time, so check back often to see what's new in the Curious Cast library.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.